The views and opinions of this podcast are solely those of the creators and do not reflect any streaming service or platform. This podcast contains strong language and contrarian viewpoints that may be objectional to some listeners. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to the Three Geeks in a Microphone podcast. I'm Dean.
I'm Art.
I'm Russ.
And today we are going to be discussing the 1986 film Manhunter that was based on the Thomas Harris novel Red Dragon that was released in 1981. Let's see. The movie was done on a $15 million budget, but only made $4 million in North America and $8.6 million globally. So in 86, I would have been 10. So what do you guys remember about 86?
The Challenger.
Yeah, I remember the Challenger. I also remember when Chernobyl, and they had all the fear of acid rain.
Yep. So it's quite the interesting movie. This was directed by Michael Mann, who's best known as being the producer for Miami Vice from 84 to 89. And this is also the second production from William Peterson. Michael Mann cast him after he saw To Live and Die in L.A. in 85, which will be another movie we're doing. What were you guys, what was your overall impression? No, first of all, do you guys remember this movie at all when you were a kid? I don't.
No, I honestly, when you brought it up, Manhunter, I thought it was going to be some kind of action flick, like some kind of low budget, because but it wasn't until I started watching it and then I realized, oh, this is the one that I had. I didn't remember the name of it, but I remember hearing of the movie that was made in 80s that was based off of Hannibal Lecter and the Red Dragon and all that. And so then I got into watching it, because otherwise I was like, what are you making me watch here?
Well, this particular movie, it's the first ever incarnation of Hannibal Lecter on screen. Originally, they wanted to call it Red Dragon, but from what I was looking into it, from what I understand, the Michael Mann didn't want to call it that because he thought audiences would confuse it for a martial arts flick. So at the last minute, they changed the name to Manhunter.
You know, he probably has a point, because when Red Dragon, the one named Red Dragon, came out, what, about 10 years ago?
2002.
Oh, wow. Wow, yep. I'm feeling really old.
Yep.
Right in 1985, 86, ninja and martial arts movies were all over the place. Look at The Last Dragon. All that stuff was... So I could see where he probably had a point. A lot of people probably would go see it to thinking it was some kind of kung fu flick. And
yeah, boy, would they be disappointed.
Right.
Or some would probably be like, yeah, this is a lot better than Kung Fu.
Well, obviously everyone knows the very first movie was Silence of the Lambs. And then there was a hiatus, and they finally got, good Lord, what is his name? Guy who plays Hannibal Lecter. What the hell is his name? Anthony Hopkins. They persuaded Anthony Hopkins to come back to do Hannibal, and then they did Red Dragon last, so they kind of did them out of order. And then I don't even want to get into the other crazy sequels, Hannibal Rising and whatnot. So
I didn't even know there was one, so I've been sheltered, I guess.
So you, like I said, I never heard of this movie when I was a kid. You guys didn't either, right?
No, no.
All right. So what was your, upon initial watch through, what was your, what did you think?
Well, with me, at first, I was seeing it, that opening scene where he's in the room looking and kind of getting a feel for what the killer did. I was feeling like, oh, this might be a little bit slow, not that good. And then after I started watching it, I got into it more. It felt a little dated, you know, just because how they... And then also having seen Red Dragon, which, while I enjoyed Manhunter, Red Dragon blows it out of the water. I mean, it's so different. It's modern versus...
It's definitely a time capsule piece.
Yes.
I mean, and the thing that got me is the very opening scene when you're seeing through the killer's eyes and he's going up the stairs. And the way that was shot is it's very creepy. And I guess they purposely shot it that way so it looked grainy. They wanted the picture to be grainy and things kind of out of focus. So, but you're right. The movie itself is a time capsule of the time it was put in.
Yeah.
And the thing I wanted to know is, you know, watching it as the killer's going up the stairs, he's standing in the doorway and he's got a flashlight. He says, why does it take Mrs. Leeds so long to wake up when someone is shining a flashlight in your face in a pitch black room? And why does she not freak the fuck out to awaken with some tall guy standing in the doorway? I mean, who here has been awakened like that? I mean, Art and I, we're both ex-military. Have you ever been awakened for fire watch with a flashlight, Art?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, just regular watch on a ship. I mean, I could see it, though, as a civilian. You sleep a lot heavier and may not notice it.
And maybe she took some sleeping pills.
And mother's little helper, you know.
Could maybe be. I'm
closet alcoholic.
Oh. So then we, you know, it continues on and we see, what's his name? Dennis Farina talking. You know, go ahead.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but that's one thing. I love the guy. But in this movie, he just kept taking me out of the story.
Really? Him.
Yeah, I don't know why. It's just like I just kept picturing him in all the different little cheesy mafia movies or bit shows that he's done. And so I think I would have enjoyed the movie more if it would have been – if he would have – someone else. And it's not his fault. It's just the way my own mind works. But you mentioned his name. I'm just kind of – right now I'm picturing his – gray curly hair and his mustache, and I'm seeing him in all the roles. He's like, he never changes.
So right.
Same problem with William Peterson almost from the get-go is the lead. William Peterson is Will Graham.
Right.
Because going into this, you know, having never seen it, but knowing about it, I wanted to like it. I really did. You know, especially because of what, you know, when it was made. And like Russ said, it being a time capsule movie, but I kept watching William Peterson and thinking, God, they should have gotten Richard Dreyfuss. It was like they wanted Richard Dreyfuss, but couldn't afford him. Richard Dreyfuss.
Yes, I now that you bring that up, I'm like, this guy reminds me of someone, and that's who it is. It's like Richard Dreyfuss, and then the scene when he throws the reporter on the car windshield.
Right.
I'm like, part of me is like, there's no way that guy has that much strength. I'm sorry. I'm like, okay, some stuntman just flipped that dude on that car. You know, it kind of took me out. And plus, what kind of – I understand it's tense, but where's the self-control, okay?
Well, you know, the thing that did it for me was Well, when you mentioned Richard Dreyfuss, I would have never pictured him in a role like this. But until you mentioned it, yeah, I guess he, William Peterson at that time, does look like Richard Dreyfuss when he did like Jaws.
Yeah.
You know, like a late 70s, early 80s Richard Dreyfuss, you know, when he still had a little hair. So, but I never noticed. Yeah, I guess the two do look alike in a way. But I don't know. I can't know if I could picture Richard Dreyfuss in this role. Now, I like William Peterson, and I've read the book. Do you guys read the book?
Yeah, it's been years, but yeah.
So
no, I haven't, so I'm at a disadvantage there.
Graham is a really – he's damaged. He's emotionally damaged from all of the shit he's done, and I think Peterson actually portrays that better than, what is his name? The guy that was in the Ed Norton.
Yeah.
I never got that sense of, you know, I'm damaged because of my work, you know, because of everything I've experienced from Ed Norton. It almost felt forced. With this, though, I could feel it. He doesn't want to go back and do it again. But in that opening scene when they're talking on the log. And you can just see he doesn't want to do it. And then he hands in the picture of the family. And he reluctantly agrees because he knows if he doesn't, it's going to keep going. So he's willing to. In the book, the thing about Graham is he can step inside the killer's mind in a way. He almost experiences what the killer does, and he hates it. Did any of you guys ever watch the Hannibal TV show while it was out?
No, I haven't.
I can't think of the guy's name who portrays Graham in that show, but he does it really well. Peterson reminded me of this other guy in this movie because you can just feel that he's damaged, you know? So they're talking on the log, and you know he agrees to do it. Now, when I was doing some, did you notice the lighting? Like, for example, in the next scene, Graham and his wife are talking in bed, and it's a gorgeous house, by the way. And did you ever notice when Graham's at home in Florida, the central lighting theme is blue? Did you notice that?
Yeah, it looked like they were trying to make it look like calmer at home.
Well, what was interesting here is the cinematographer Dante Spinotti. He used strong color tints for the film. He used like romantic blue tones to denote scenes featuring Graham and his wife. He did green hues with elements of purple for unsettling scenes. They used different elements of color to pull in a reaction from the audience, an emotional reaction. And once you know it's there, go back and watch it again, and it really works. Like, for example, when he comes out after talking to Lecter, you know, he wigs out and he's running out. And everything, you notice everything in there was sterile. Everything was white. But when he gets out, the first thing he does is he starts staring into the grass, which is this oversaturated green. They purposely did that to denote a sense of calm in the audience. Another example is when you go back and watch the scene where the Tooth Fairy has Lowndes tied up and he's showing him the Red Dragon. Everything in there are browns, dark tones, and elements of purple. But when you see the house later, when he's with, what was her name? The girlfriend.
The blind woman.
Yeah. What is her name?
Reba.
Played by an actor named Joan Allen. When towards the end of the movie, when he's there with her, you don't see those colors. everything's kind of muted and gray.
No, but that whole like inside of that house, like during the last fight scene, I want somebody to re-edit that, but with the music from Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Oh gosh, that I'm
a blind woman running around in the background. I'd love to see that music replaced with the music from Benny Hill.
I was just thinking that too. I was like Benny Hill.
Oh God. So, you know, no, go ahead.
Bring up that fight scene. I'm sure we'll probably get to it in a minute, but man, I just started laughing.
You know, here's a little tidbit. So when Graham agrees and then he goes out to the Leeds house to do a walkthrough. Now he's sitting in the patrol car before he goes in. You know, you see him, he's getting his tape recorder out of his bag and he's getting everything together. And the cop that's talking to him, he says, you know, we set up a video recorder in your hotel room. He's like, do you want me to walk through you or through the house with you? And he's like, no, I want to do this myself. Did any of you guys recognize him? I did. The cop that's sitting in the patrol car with Graham.
No, I'm drawing a blank.
His name is Marshall Bell, and he played Coach Schneider from A Nightmare on Elm Street 2.
Oh.
He's been in a couple different things. I recognized his voice when I was watching it. I'm like, I know that guy. So the other thing I noticed about this is since it was directed by Michael Mann, and like we said earlier, Michael Mann did Miami Vice, I got a very mid-80s Miami Vice feel to this, especially the way the camera work is. Yeah, it's really unique. I'm sorry, go ahead.
It was at a way, way slower pace, though. And the editing was kind of crazy. Like when Will was in the grocery store with his son.
Oh, yeah. I'll get to that. Hold up on that. I have a whole section on that. So, but I don't, like I said, I thought it was really unique in the Leeds house, for example. When we talk about a time capsule, it's the aesthetic of that house is so 80s, it's sick. Especially like when he flips on the light to the bedroom. I mean, you got this tufted bed on a platform, and you got the on the right, you know, the white dresser with the gold trim. I mean, this whole movie is just pure 1980s.
Yeah. And that's part of its charm, really, because I think part of me enjoyed watching some of the 80s styles and the 80s vibe that came off of this more than I did the actual story in the entire movie, just because I've seen Red Dragon and it's so much more fast-paced.
Oh, definitely.
I kept hoping to see Crockett and Tubbs walking around in the background.
It's like,
this would have been awesome.
The pop culture fan in me is like, why couldn't they have gone to a toy store? I want to see the vintage toys hanging on the aisle. The pegs.
But, you know, interestingly, though, I noticed something that, okay, do you remember towards the end, when they finally figure out where Dollar Hyde is, and they're on the plane and they're talking to the cop, right? And, you know, they're running names to try to figure out who he is. The guy, the cop that's running the number, that's running the names, is the same actor that played Barney the Orderly from Silence of the Lambs and Hannibal.
Nice. I did not know that.
So as I was watching it, I'm like, I recognized his voice, but I couldn't place it. So I looked it up and I'm like, I'll be damned. This guy has been in three different Thomas Harris movies. One is a cop and then two is the orderly. His name's Frankie Faison, F-A-I-S-O-N. He's been in a number of different things, but he's mostly known for doing Silence of the Lambs and Hannibal. But so what did you guys think of the soundtrack?
It was okay. I mean, it wasn't like I'm going to go out and buy it.
What'd you say, Art?
It was okay. I mean, it wasn't great. I had hoped going in that it would be more like Miami Vice. You know, Miami Vice was like MTV almost.
Right. Yeah. Well,
they constantly had pop music on that show.
Well, I guess for Miami Vice, when they came up with the idea for it, Michael Mann literally wrote down MTV Cops. That's what he was going for. I don't know. The soundtrack is available on Spotify, and I've been listening to it for the last couple of weeks, and I actually like it because it's got a new wave sound to it, and I believe the main artist was a band called Red 7. I had never heard of them before seeing this, but I guess like a year before when production had first started, Michael Mann was in a club in L.A. and they were playing. And he liked them so much, he walked up to him and immediately hired him to do the soundtrack for this movie. So most of the stuff on here, it has a really creepy new wave vibe to it.
Yeah, I can see that, or I hear that, however you want to say it.
I kind of feel like we just delved into American Psycho for a second, but yeah, I can see that.
Right. Although, I definitely love the use of Iron Butterfly's song at the end.
Yes, that was pretty cool.
It was definitely unexpected. If you hadn't have listened to the soundtrack and knew it was coming, considering what came before it, it's kind of jarring, wouldn't you think?
Yeah. Well, to me, it was a pleasant surprise.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm like, cool, I like this song.
And the other thing I noticed that's completely ridiculous, but it adds to the aesthetic of the movie itself. Did you notice most of the interiors, the interior rooms of the movie, they're very modern and they're very minimalist?
Well, yeah, like that conference room, it looked like they took that right off the set of Buck Rogers.
Right.
Yeah.
Or the Dr. Chilton, when they discover the letter that he had written the Tooth Fairy on. No doctor I've ever seen would have an office like that. I mean, I've worked in hospitals, and every doctor I've ever seen, they have shit all over their desks, books, papers. You walk in there, and it's this white desk with this slate gray background with a modern chair and this ridiculously looking modern telephone, and he's got nothing on his desk. I'm like, no doctor I've ever seen works like that. So, but me personally, I like modern minimalist interiors, so I kind of liked it. But in, like you said earlier, Art, like the Tooth Fairy's house, that looks like it was a cross between, you know, modern architecture in the 1950s. That right. Kitchen looked like it could have been pulled out of the 50s.
Or right out of Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Right. Hey, nothing matched.
Yeah, I'd really love to see that fight scene dubbed the theme music to Pee-wee's Playhouse.
So we go through and he sees the leads. If you've seen the movie Red Dragon, it follows the plot almost perfectly, with a few other changes. Now, once the Tooth Fairy makes a threat against Graham, they get the wife and kids out and they go to a safe house, and they're walking through the grocery store.
Yeah, this is awesome.
If you can completely ignore what Graham's talking to his son and you just look at the background.
I was doing that. I'm like, look at the different products.
Right. It's, again, it's a crazy time capsule. I mean, going through there, I saw Mr. T cereal. I saw
those cases, the little mini boxes.
Yep. I saw Sugar Smacks. Now, the thing that really blew my mind, though, is when they're walking through, if you look closely, behind Graham is like cereal and whatnot. And I think, I'm trying to remember what was behind the sun.
Well, at one point, it's like pudding and like Jell-O and
right
and stuff like that. And then like a second later, I think that it was like soups and stuff.
Right. It there's a screw up in the editing and it jumps down the aisle.
Yeah, like whereas 10 feet.
Right. Whereas the kid, the things change behind him from Jell-O to coffee. But behind Graham, it's the same cereal until they start walking again. And I noticed it watching the back. I'm like, that's a huge continuity error. But if you weren't looking at the background, you would never notice it. But I tell you, all those products, I would kill to get to reach my hand in and grab some of that stuff. Because some of that stuff doesn't exist anymore.
Oh, yeah.
Especially the Mr. T cereal.
Right.
See, that's and not to, you know, completely change the subject of what we're talking about, but that's one of the benefits that I have with my job working in a food bank is that people will donate stuff. And when someone, this is a little morbid, but when someone passes away, sometimes they just clean out the shelves and donate the food, and we have to sort through it. I have in my possession, remember those vacuum sealed Folgers coffee bricks?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I have one. When was the last time you've seen one?
God, I think they stopped making those in the 90s, didn't they?
Early 90s, definitely. Yeah, this one, you know, it's like I have one. It's like I used to love opening those as a kid. Right around 1986, the same time period, about the time when that coffee came out.
Russ is going to be the only one of us that survives an apocalypse, and it's because he's got coffee.
Well, yeah, I always laugh. It's like if the zombie apocalypse happens, I got keys to the food bank. I'm good.
That's if someone doesn't break in first.
Ah, yeah, no one's going to break into that place.
So the other tidbit I found that I thought was kind of interesting. So do you remember the scene when Graham's on a flight and he's got, you know, these pictures up and he's working on the case on this flight and there's like a little girl and a mom sitting next to him on the plane, and he falls asleep, and the little girl freaks out because, you know, he's got a picture of a body with, you know, glass in its eyes. You remember what I'm talking about?
Right.
The production staff couldn't get permission to film on board a commercial airplane. So Michael Mann booked all his actors and actresses onto a Twilight flight from Chicago to Florida, with the production crew, waiting. And what they did is they brought in a stripped down camera lighting and equipment on board as carry-on luggage and filmed that scene with people on that charter flight. In the end, they ended up giving t-shirts and crew jackets to all the members of the flight crew and the passengers for allowing them to film. Otherwise, since the airlines wouldn't allow them to film on board, they had to do it this way to get that scene. They weren't paid. They were given T-shirts. So I just thought that was kind of interesting. So we get to the end. And, you know, obviously this shootout with Graham and the Tooth Fairy. When Graham shoots the Tooth Fairy and he hits the ground, you notice the huge pool of blood he was in? The actor who did that actually got stuck to the floor.
I'm sorry. That's funny.
They put so much of this fake blood down, it congealed, and he got stuck to the floor. they had to pry him off when they finally finished shooting.
That actually happened to Bruce Campbell once when they were filming the first Evil Dead movie, because they were using like Karo syrup and peanut butter to make the blood.
Right.
His shirt, because they didn't have heating in that cabin of any kind, and it was like February, his shirt actually froze. And the reason it was torn up the way it was, or there was continuity errors, because it actually, the shirt broke.
See, it's with Bruce Campbell, it's not funny. It's interesting. But with this guy who played the Red Dragon being stuck to the floor, just makes me laugh.
Interestingly, the guy who played Dollar Hyde, his name is Tom Noonan. Now, have you guys seen Monster Squad?
Yeah.
Frankenstein.
Frankenstein?
Yep. Same guy who played Frankenstein played Dollar Hyde in this.
He was also now, Last Action Hero.
Yep. I don't know. I mean, I found the guy creepy.
Oh, yeah. His bodily movements, I mean, were eerie. I mean, he was good, but I would have rather seen Malkovich play that part.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah.
But...
Or Matt Frewer.
That'd be interesting. Max Headroom playing...
It's not like neither one of them weren't big or around back then. They were.
This is true.
They would have had the right build for it, too.
Yeah, I can see that. Now, like I said, the one thing I didn't get from him, though, that I got from, what is his name? The guy who played Dollar Hyde in the 2002 movie, Ralph Fiennes. Fiennes, not only did you get a sense of danger with him that he could snap at any moment, but you almost felt sorry for him because of what he'd been through. This guy, I didn't really get that. And the whole scene towards the end where he's walking through the videotape transfer place and he's wearing his wardrobe looked like it came out of a really bad mall in about 85.
Yeah.
And what's up with the weird blue glasses? Did you notice that? He's walking through and he puts on these ridiculous looking blue sunglasses. I'm like, I'm supposed to be afraid of this guy?
Right. One thing I will say, whoever did the makeup on that cleft lip scar in this Manhunter did really good. Because, as you both know, I was born with a bilateral cleft lip and palate, which... makes it a little interesting for me to watch, because I know in the Red Dragon, I didn't get it quite so much in Manhunter, but in the movie Red Dragon from 2002, you say it was?
Mm-hmm.
They had the guy talk with the nasal because of the palate repair, and they made it a little bit more obvious that there was this birth defect that was going on, which also makes me wonder, it's like, am I a serial killer waiting to happen because I have a cleft lip? Because it's how, it's kind of because they say the Leatherface had one too, which whatever, rabbit holing there. But watching the actor who played Tooth Hunter.
Oh, the Tooth Fairy.
Tooth Fairy, yeah. Sorry, I'm dyslexic. I can't even talk right. But
that's all right.
But yeah, watching, like you said, you're not afraid of him. You're kind of like you. It's kind of like that dweeb that you see walking around the store, and you don't really know why, but you just want to kind of like push him over and laugh, because it's just kind of like there's something, a vibe that comes off of him that's just kind of like you're not a jerk, but there's something about this person that you just don't like, and so you kind of want to take out some kind of repressed aggression on him. But I do like the makeup job that they did with the cleft scar.
Okay.
You're like, whatever, you weirdo.
Well, it's interesting because, like I said, there was a few times when, yeah, it looked like there's like seething rage under the surface. But at no point did I ever feel that this guy was menacing. You know, I mean, because you never see him like when he takes the leads. You never see him do it. That's all done off camera. But, yeah, he's creepy, but I don't get the, oh, my God, this guy could snap in any moment and kill me right. Vibe from him.
Yeah,
that's why I think Malkovich could have pulled that off way better.
Oh, definitely. I mean, like, if this guy, it's like, even if you see the anger and rage, and that's what I think I'm coming from, you know, what I'm talking about, is like, you see this doofus walking around, and you kind of just get, that guy's creepy, and you pick up, it's almost like you pick up on that sublime anger and aggression, and it's kind of like you just want to push him over just to make him more angry, just to laugh at him, because he's not intimidating.
They're all going to laugh at you.
Okay, so I guess the elephant in the room here is, okay, what did you guys think of Brian Cox as Lecter?
You know, actually, I thought he would... Oh, sorry, go ahead, Russ. Oh,
you go for it.
I thought he was good. He's not somebody that I would have thought of from that time period, but I almost would have liked to have seen him do it again at least one more time. And then Anthony Hopkins. I mean, he was definitely by no means Anthony Hopkins, but I thought he was good. I have to admit that definitely upped my respect for him.
I would agree, because they approached the character differently. From what I read, when he was cast in the role, Brian Cox based his performance off interviews that he watched with a Scottish serial killer, and I did not write the name down, but he studied this guy and he based his performance on him. Now, Anthony Hopkins is creepy because you guys realize, at least in Silence of the Lambs, you know, he never blinks. Anthony Hopkins, he never blinks through the whole movie.
Yeah.
And I think Anthony Hopkins' take is, I'm this really refined gentleman who has refined tastes, but he also is twisted, will cut you to pieces and eat you if you find he's rude, you know, if you're rude to him. But I didn't get that from Brian Cox. I didn't get the, I'm a highly educated nobility family or upbringing. Yes, he's incredibly intelligent. That comes through. But I don't know.
You're saying that Anthony Hopkins carried off the aristocratic side better.
Yes. Yes. Anthony Hopkins portrayed it more like, well, a very arrogant but very intelligent psychiatrist. They even say it in the movies and the books that, like, when anyone comes to interview him, he just insults them and they leave. But in Brian Cox's case, I don't know, he was more, obviously you could feel the fact that he's crazy. You follow what I mean?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, especially when he made that phone call to find out where Peterson lived.
Right. And you even get a sense of that in the second phone call he makes to Graham when Graham's in the hotel room. I mean, Graham's sitting there. You can see it on his face that he's trepidatious about this call. I mean, he's chain smoking while he's talking to him. And then they show Lecter, who's just lounging on his bed, talking to him just to get a rise out of him. You don't see that with Anthony Hopkins. Brian Cox took joy out of making Graham uncomfortable. Or am I out of my depth here?
I think you're right.
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, I'm just kind of thinking about both what you said, because I really, trying to compare him to Anthony Hopkins is really, you know, not fair in one way, because Hopkins just is so good and everyone associates with Hannibal Lecter with Hopkins. The poor guy, you know, is like,
right,
he can't even go shopping anymore with someone asking if he wants, you know, nice Chianti and
fava beans.
But I didn't dislike the guy's performance in Manhunter. I think when it comes down to it, Manhunter would have been way better if I had never seen Silence of the Lambs or Red Dragon or anything with Hopkins before.
Yeah, I could see that, because you have nothing to measure it against.
Right, where the whole time after I realized what I was watching, I'm kind of like, oh, this is Red Dragon wannabe. And even though it came out first, it's kind of like...
Right. I mean, I think the only reason why... Let's face it, this movie died at the box office. Now, I didn't look, I need to see what else was released at the same time. I wonder if it just got trounced by a larger movie, because it's, for its time period, it's not a bad flick. It's very stylized. I mean, if you're going in thinking it's an action film, you're going to be really disappointed. For what it is, it was a good first attempt to bring Lecter to life. And I agree with you, yeah. Art. I think if he had played Lecter a second time and maybe refined it a little more, I think we might be talking about his performance rather than Anthony Hopkins.
This movie came out in 1986, so it was going up against Short Circuit, Top Gun, Stand By Me, Crocodile Dundee, Flight of the Navigator, Three Amigos, The Wraith.
Yeah. Oh, it got crushed. I mean, if I...
Oh, yeah. Aliens came out that year. Ferris Bueller, The Labyrinth, Big Trouble in China, Rats.
And it was also... It was the mid-80s. Everyone wasn't into psychological thrillers. They were into big blockbusters. They were into action flicks, ninja movies.
One of the
movies.
Biggest ones that came out, that the two biggest ones, well, two of the bigger ones, were Little Shop of Horrors and Star Trek IV, The Wrath, or Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, and Aliens. So it didn't have a prayer.
Right. And as far as I know, it got a wide release. But yeah, you're right. With the competition it had, it would have gotten crushed anyhow.
Yeah, just looking at a quick little thing of what movies were released at the same time, movies in theater the week of, you know, you have like Howard the Duck, Friday the 13th, Part 6. Yeah, I'm just doing a quick little search here.
Sure.
So, and it was also still the time period where VHS were expensive. Sure, you could rent movies, but movies just lasted longer in the theater.
I mean, I can tell you right now why I didn't see this in 1986. I was too busy watching Star Trek IV.
Right. I mean, and I would have been watching Top Gun. You know, I mean, I don't even remember this movie being released. At least, then again, I was 10 years old. It's probably not something I would have really looked into at the time. But, I mean, I first heard about this in... What, like the late 90s, early 2000s, I guess, someone had mentioned Silence of the Lambs was not the first movie to feature Hannibal Lecter. And so I looked it up and I'm like, huh, okay. But I never saw it and didn't look for it until we decided to do this. And I said, you know, it's so unique. It's such an obscure movie. Let's start with this.
Oh. I'm sorry. I don't mean to interrupt you.
No, no.
I just figured out. Okay, so August 15th, 1986, at the same time this one, Manhunter, was released. This explains why it went unknown. The Boy Who Could Fly was released on the same day. That took away all steam.
Yeah, it just crushed it, right?
yeah. The Boy Who Could Fly killed it. We can blame that.
Jay Underwood.
So let me ask you this, guys. Do you think it, okay, is it worth someone going out and finding just to see it?
I would say yes, especially if they're a Silence of the Lambs, Red Dragon fan, just to see. It's kind of like having a first issue comic. It's not the best comic always, but it's the beginning. It's something that you just to see, to say that you've seen it, and it gives you appreciate the Hopkins portrayal more. I appreciate the movies that, you know, the ones that get more attention more because they obviously had a bigger budget, more widespread release, more didn't go up against The Boy Who Could Fly.
or Top Gun.
yeah. You know, so it's kind of one of those things where it feels like it's not the best one. And it's not the best movie, and it's definitely not one I'd go out and buy on DVD to have in my video library to pull out and watch every other day or anything like that. But it's definitely, for the historic significance of it, it's definitely worth a watch, in my opinion.
Okay. Art, what do you think?
I'm kind of on the fence. I mean, part of me was like, oh, this was such a slow movie. It was like a double root canal with a cactus up your ass. I mean, it was like, God, it was unbelievably slow. But at the same time, there was unique points to the movie, like, again, Brian Cox. Somebody you would never think of as Hannibal Lecter. You know, because when I think of Brian Cox, I think of the sleazy uncle in the movie The Ringer with Johnny Knoxville.
Right.
You know, where he gets into the Special Olympics.
Or the guy from the Bourne films.
Yeah, and Chris Elliott was in the conference room scene.
Yep, I forgot about that.
Again, is an interesting token. It's just like, he's there. You know, he just kind of crops up like in that movie, The Dictator. He was a security outside of the hotel. You don't even realize it's him till afterwards. But in a way, it's kind of funny like that. But, you know, and as a time capsule movie, it's not terrible, especially because of the jump scene in the grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
But now, that's definitely up. Your mileage may vary with this movie.
Mm.
Now, you know, me, I mean, it depends on what you're into. I mean, if you're really like Russ said, if you're really into the Hannibal Lecter movies, it's worth seeing. But know going into it that it's not good.
Or not great.
Not great. Yeah. I didn't like William Peterson in this movie, but I did like him in To Live and Die in L.A.
Yep, and that's another one we're going to be reviewing. Now,
overall, though, again, it's up to, you know, user-defined settings. You know, if you want to watch it, watch it. I mean, it is interesting, like Russ said. It is the first Hannibal Lecter movie ever made, but don't get your hopes up with it.
I gotcha. Now, for me, I liked the aesthetics of the movie, the way it was shot, the lighting, especially the filming locations, even more so than what I say a time capsule movie. It almost has an art house quality to it. It's like almost like a film student's project. Well, like I was saying though, it has like this art house style to it. It's shot very uniquely. The lighting and the setting is incredibly stylized. It's almost like Miami Vice meets Hannibal Lecter. And for that alone, I think it's worth viewing at least once just to see how it was shot. But you're right. As on a whole, I would probably rate it, I don't know, maybe a 7.5, 8 out of 10. I mean, it's not a bad movie, but it's not great either. But like you said, Roz, everything's got to start somewhere. It was the first attempt, and it got better as it went down the road, of course. And then again, I like William Peterson. Now, I wasn't like a huge CSI fan, for example. I like him as an actor because he can portray this damaged, almost downtrodden investigator almost as good as the guy who did it for the Hannibal TV show. Which is something else we should talk about eventually here, but I like him. But I agree with you, Art. He was better in To Live and Die in L.A., but I wouldn't knock this completely. And it's at least worth watching once just to see how it was shot. Those are just in my opinion, anyhow.
Yeah, and see, when I said it was slow, you're talking to a guy, though, that actually enjoyed Star Trek The Motion Picture. I thought this movie was slow.
Yeah, it definitely was slow. It reminds me of watching a soap opera with my grandma when I was a kid.
Jeez, oh, I didn't think it was that bad.
Well, you know, it's like it had its moments. Then, like, yeah, like when they had Iron Butterfly and the guy jumps through the window, which I don't understand. Why didn't he just shoot him? He had a gun.
Because the plot needed it to happen?
Could have been a dozen different reasons. He wasn't sure about clear line of sight with a girl in the room.
Yeah. Yep.
It was also dark, so he might not have been able to get a good aim on his target. Plus, he didn't know how thick the glass was.
Which also leads to, why was he jumping through it?
Yeah, it's kind of like...
Very true. Like, oh! Like a bird hitting a window, you know, bam! And that,
you know, honestly, the dude doesn't look like he's very big. If he was able to break that window that easily, jumping through it, you know, it kind of makes you wonder about, pretty thin glass, obviously not double pane. He makes it through the first layer and bounces off the second. It just, it's just kind of that part there, while I understand it's for the dramatic effect and dire need of emergency help. Have you guys worked with glass very much?
A little.
Yeah, that's actually what I use for my print beds.
Yeah, because, you know, it's stained glass. It's like that many glass shards, and he didn't get cut. There'd be, like, some serious cuts, most likely.
Right, but then again, it's the suspension of disbelief. It's like if you're watching an action movie and these guys never reload their magazines or run out of bullets. So
It's just, it's kind of like one of those things, like with those action movies, you expect that. But they're watching this dramatic movie, and everything seems to try and portray realism. And then it's like, Iron Butterfly jumps through the window.
And, you know, I'm sorry, considering the rest of the soundtrack, which at the time was, you know, like new wave, modern, if you will. Why Iron Butterfly? Of all the songs, why Iron Butterfly?
Really? You know what? It goes back to, have you ever watched like the music video or the performance, live performance or whatever they have of Iron Butterfly?
Oh, yeah.
And that in the Garden of Eden or whatever, however they say it.
In the Garden of Devita.
Yeah.
Well, the dude was so drunk he couldn't get it out. That's how it came out when he sang it. But
yeah.
Yeah.
What I love about it is that video of them performing kind of made when I saw my brain.
We can come back to it.
When he had the guy, the reporter, tied up, his room.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it reminded me of like a 60s hippie type of vibe. His entire house kind of made me think of that time period. So having Iron Butterfly, it kind of, I don't know, maybe I'm...
It fit the aesthetic of the room?
That was all the more reason the man shouldn't have beat that guy down. He was a hippie.
Yeah, you know, and that's what it reminds me of. It's like one of those hippies from the 60s that's trying to blend in with the 80s.
Okay, I can see that. I mean, he did have long hair, even though he's starting to bald.
Now his body movements make more sense. He was tripping out on acid.
What was up with the, when he takes her to see the tiger, what is up with that weird look on his face when he's staring at her? I mean, in that moment, you know, does he want to kill her or fuck her? I mean, I don't get it. It's like...
Dude, he wants to do both.
I think he was trying to reason out in his head which way to do that or which order to do that. Do I kill her or do I fuck her? Do I fuck her first, then kill her? Maybe both at the same time. Choke her out.
And how do I get the tiger involved?
Yeah. I'm never going to financially recover from this.
That part there, it's like, it cracks me up because I understand it's supposed to be like this moving moment for her to... because she's blind and everything, but I'm sorry. Seeing, not seeing, hearing, not hearing, whatever, perfectly healthy. If I'm just taking off with some random person for the first time, or however they know each other, and they take me to see a tiger, I'm like, you're weird. Bye.
Even worse, like when they're sitting, you know, at the end of that date, when they're back in his house, she's like, what are you watching? Oh, just, you know, a family I'm going to visit. I'm like, really? This isn't a red flag that, you know, he's watching home movies of someone else? I mean, who takes that kind of work home with them? I don't know. But from one to 10, 1 being pure garbage, 10 being the best movie ever, where do you rate it?
I'd say a 4.
A 4? That low? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
I was thinking 4 or 5. I give it actually, you know what? I'll give it a 5 just because I love the scene when after he kills the reporter and for some reason he's on fire, rolling down in a wheelchair in the parking garage.
Actually, I think I could give it. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Russ.
I mean, I saw that and I just started laughing. That was some of the funniest stuff I've seen.
Honestly, now that I think about it, and I think Russ is right, because they whacked the reporter in such a unique way, I could honestly see giving it a 5.
Well, they, interestingly, they do that in the book, and they also do it in Red Dragon. But what they didn't show is, and but they talk about in Red Dragon, is he glued him to the chair.
Yeah, that should have been the punishment, though, for fake news.
Oh, shit. Then they set him on fire and set him down in the parking garage. Who's sleazier? The guy who was playing this version of Lowndes or Philip Seymour Hoffman? I thought Philip Seymour Hoffman was way out of place in Red Dragon. This guy was way sleazier.
Yeah, yeah, this guy, when this guy got killed, I was like...
Stephen Lang is the actor's name.
Yeah, yeah. I was like, you're on fire. You know, just kind of laughing.
All right, well, how do you guys... definitely at least a watch through once, right?
Yeah, I would say. Yeah, if anything, you gotta watch
nothing else to do, or your other option is masturbate with a glove made out of shards of glass. Yeah.
All right. Well, I think that'll wrap this up for this episode. Any other last thoughts, guys?
No, this is kind of fun. Hopefully, I didn't sound too stupid.
I'm still recording, by the way.
Yeah, I know. You can leave that in there. It's like, it's my disclaimer. I'm not the sharpest tool in this shed.
Well, everyone, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on the next episode.